This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
We're all part of a global capitalist economy, a system that promised to benefit the rich and the poor equally. Yet in 2022, youth unemployment rate has been on the rise. Salaries have stagnated for close to 20 years, despite the massive increase in cost of living. The cost of education is at an all-time high, and the average millennial and Gen Z cannot even afford adequate housing on a single paycheck, despite it being a fundamental human right. So what went wrong? And what exactly is the solution here? I'm Dashran Johan, and this is Think Left on Beyond the Ballot Box, a series that explores various issues through a leftist or socialist prism with Parti Socialist Malaysia. On the first episode of the series, we take a look at what exactly is socialism, especially in the 21st century. I'm joined on this episode by Sivarajan Arumugam. He's the Secretary General at Parti Socialist Malaysia. Welcome to the show, Siva.
Hi, Dashran, and thanks for having me here again.
So, Siva, before we get into what exactly socialism is, let's talk about the system in which we currently live in, which is a capitalistic system, a system called capitalism. How did capitalism come to be, and what role did it play in global development and production?
The economic system that before capitalism itself, we can say that it was feudalism, economy which was mainly dominantly agriculture. But most of the land and most of the resources were controlled by the kings and below them the nobles and so on. And of course, we had the merchant class which went out and did some businesses with other countries and so on. But what we see under feudalism itself, of course, any kind of economy, there will be surplus in the economy. So besides what they pay taxes to the kings and besides what they are giving back to the state, there was not much how the surplus itself was used. And there was really not much an avenue for whoever owned the surplus value to really reinvest, because there's nothing, no industries to reinvest. There's no really a huge population they could sell products to. So it is very much closed. But this is where I think we also saw that the merchants felt that this was a shortcoming in terms of they could not expand their businesses. So in a way that that's why there was a revolution, and then the people who are working in the lands, the farming lands, the peasants, so they really joined hand with some of the bourgeoisie sort of to overthrow the kings themselves. So in terms of economic system, we find that this is how slowly the capitalist model sort of developed. And once that people sort of being evicted from their lands themselves, and this merchant and this business, new emerging business class, what they found is that they could be more productive, or they could make use of or expand this productive system by bringing together this individual tradesmen, meaning people like those days, we have individual tradesmen, people who make shoes,
right,
people who make braids, people who make clothes. And they were in cottage industries doing whatever they could supply to their own community, small villages and so on. But as these merchants were also doing investment, and they also doing businesses overseas, so they found that there is a market for it, right? So they brought all of these people together, put them under one roof. And today is the same roof that we call as factories. And they losing their independence as individual tradesmen, and they could not compete with the bigger businesses, bringing them all together and making them into a workforce. So a tradesman being someone who owns his own trades and own businesses, now they end up only selling their labor to this big business. So that is how the transition happened. And it happened in parallel, whereby as the expansion of the businesses and the merchants were going on, they were also sort of taking over land. They were fencing up the commons. So people who had land before, they would lose their land, and such they were had nowhere to work, and they could only come to the cities where they could sell their labor. So this was a free labor force that they could use. So parallelly, this is what happened, where the eviction of peasants also happened. At the same time, also we found that this is expansion. So that is why we also have, like those days, when the Industrial Revolution,
right,
when we have the mill, the steam engine,
yep,
And we look at it as a technological advancement. But the other side of it is also because when the cotton mills were produced, so whereby we found that these businesses and small bourgeois businessmen, they have these huge plantations, you know, and they brought in labor. Slavery was there for more than 400 over years, you know, brought in slaves from Africa and so on. So the whole thing expanded. And later we will also find that how these things sort of like emerges into the whole colonial project. Now, basically, the colonial project, if you look at it, it is an economic project, right?
Right.
I mean, I doubt that those people in Europe and Britain and all that, they just thought that their way of life was nice and let's spread it around the world.
Right.
Obviously not, right?
It's never about that.
It's never about that. So it's basically an economic project,
right,
where these merchants, they went and they found abundance of resources throughout the world in the third world countries. It's wrong to call it a third world country because they were more developed than the European nations at that particular time. So the only way they could extract the resources is by going in there and colonizing them through the arms. At that particular time, the capitalist economy itself, it was supported, it was financed militarily and also by finance by the government itself. That's why you have the British East India Company, which
right.
is fully a British company.
That's right.
But it is for capital purposes.
Yes.
So all of this goes in together to expand this whole capitalism. And as a transition from feudalism to capitalism, and it goes in hand with this whole colonial project throughout this whole world.
So on the one hand, you talk about colonial project, which at this point in history, we all know that it's bad. It brought about many negative effects to people on this side of the world and many others regions around the world. You know, but at the same time, you also talk about at one point, feudalism didn't have businesses and things in which they could reinvest their surplus and things like that. Would you say that capitalism has brought about a mixture of some good things and a lot of bad things? How do you sort of look at it? Is it just a system that didn't work altogether, or did it work for a period of time?
So capitalism, we can say, is an advancement, the next step of enhancing the class society. So meaning that, yes, it has expanded the production capacity. Yes, it has gone throughout the whole world. But what has remained is that it has concentrated wealth. It has accumulated wealth in a much greater way compared to what feudalism was able to do.
Right.
Like feudalism, of course, you have the kings, you have the whole empire. But the only way they could reinvest, as you can see in when you look at the historical sites that you go today, you'll find huge cathedrals, you'll find huge temples, huge castles. This is what they left behind, because that's the only way they could reinvest. They could go all around the world, conquer, bring back all the gold. There was no production to invest. They could just invest it back in their own palaces or their temples, you know. So, but what capitalism did is that it sort of reinforced this whole thing so that it could reinvest and accumulate more profits. And this, of course, goes in together when how the money itself becomes a commodity, you know, a commodity of exchange. So one that becomes a mode of exchange which is very well established, then the accumulation of profits is made much more easier. So that's why what capitalism has did is that the concentration of power has remained. What remained with the kings before today remains with the business elite. Any billionaire today is owning multiple times of wealth what even a king would have owned in those days, right? But yet again, the problem we always face is that it has been concentrated amongst the small percentage, the T10,
right?
And it's not distributed. So throughout this whole civilization process, what we have realized is that people, the common people, were always productive. They were always able to produce. Wealth is always created. But the problem lies is that it is not distributed. It is concentrated. So capitalism, we can find, is the highest form here today that we have, where we have immense capacity, but it's concentrated so much that we can have only like 8 people in the whole world owning the wealth amounting to the other half of the world.
Yeah.
That kind of disparity, which is unthinkable, you know.
What exactly would you say is wrong with capitalism, especially today? Because there was a point in time where, if we look back, our parents' generation or grandparents' generation, even at that point, it was still a system of capitalism, but let's say if you're my grandmother or my parents or someone in their friends, if they manage to go to university or they manage to get a job, a 9-to-5, you don't even have to be a big professional. You can still buy a house. You can buy a house and raise a family. But today, you look at even doctors, the end, you know, people who spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on education and they got master's degrees, they can't buy a house. They can't raise a family. What went wrong?
Something changed, I think, after World War II. When, of course, after World War II, we have Russia, we have China, we have the other side of what the capitalist icons would offer, US and all that. So after World War II, I think what has happened is that basically the generation of our parents, okay, at least, that they offered a lot of concessions because they felt that the left was reasonably strong. That's why it's during the Cold War period. The unions were empowered. There was always an economy that if any sovereign countries that does not wish to follow this whole capitalist model of governance, they could always rely on an alternate side. And of course, the workers' movement was also very strong. So the capitalist class, the business class, has to give a lot of concessions because of the fight back and because they did not want people to fall on the other side of the Iron Curtain.
Right.
But I think what we have after the 90s was, when the collapse of Russia and the Soviet bloc, the capitalist model had no one to contest. And it was a full-fledged going on the path of neoliberal capitalism. But the core issue that even today we as PSM, why do we talk about Marxism and so on, is that the core problem has always remained. The economic model, which is based on wage labor, as obviously we find that this economic system is whereby when workers produce, and whereby they are not given the wages according to the value they are produced. And this is the core of it.
Mm-hmm.
Until and when this change does not change, people will remain in poverty. There will be disparity. So that is why that we always feel that any kind of modifications on the capitalist system itself is a problem. It will be an improvement, but it is still a problem because we do not really address this extractive model of production, whereby it's very obvious. I mean, the workers' wages, it's never calculated according to the value that they produce. It always goes back to the cost of living. If a worker is the one who creates the value for any kind of industry, then you should give me my share. That's why
right.
We have, even today in Malaysia, we have the workers' the wages value in terms of GDP is only about less than 40%. Right? So that very clearly shows that whatever that I produce, the majority of it is taken by the business owning class, and I only get wages which is always related to the cost of living. So this mentality, this whole concept and this whole thinking, it goes back since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, whereby people were made to work for 12 hours, 16 hours, children were working. At that particular time, the mentality was that we will give you wages so that you have enough to go back home and eat, sleep, and come back to work tomorrow.
I can't help but think about the arguments that people bring up in defense of capitalism. And one of these arguments that people always bring up is that capitalism is a fair system that rewards hard work. And, like you talk about, paying people this wage to get them to go to work, to get them to contribute their labor. And under capitalism is when you get this hardworking bunch of people that, because you know that if you don't work, then you're gone case. So you have to work and it rewards hard work. And you talk about, let's say, the business owning class. A lot of people bring up the argument that that's because they are, they were smart. They were they had good ideas. They worked their fair share. And now they are the business owners. And of course, then they're going to reap most of the rewards because they are taking the bigger risk. What would your response be?
I think this is one of the successes of capitalism, or the proponents of capitalism, is that they have very really succeeded in this whole propaganda that we, until today, we believe in, that you'll be rewarded for your hard work. If that was ever true, then how can we really justify the wages and the reimbursements that the CEOs take over? If the worker gets about 1,500 ringgit for 8 hours of good work done, then how do you justify 100,000 per month? How do you justify 200,000 per month, which CEOs, even in Malaysia, are taking back? So the problem here is that workers are working hard. The reason that we can really say this with with some proof is that because as in the organization where these workers are working in, the salaries that the upper managements are getting are so huge. So meaning that these salaries which are getting, the benefits that they're getting, the perks that they're getting, it's all coming from somewhere. So someone is logging for wealth to be created, thus that these people can get those wages.
Right.
All right. Because naturally, if you can group all the CEOs in our country, group them all together, put them in a factory, let's see them work, to create the same amount of wealth that the workers are doing.
Right.
They cannot do it.
But people will argue that, but they are using their brains.
Yes.
They are coming up with the strategies and all of that. So that's why they are getting the 100,000.
What is manual work? What is manual work and what is mental work or the work of thinking and all that? While in our course of work, I've been with workers doing rubber tapping because I wanted to experience it. A couple of times I've been. There's so much of thinking going on. On how to do, where to go by, how do you label the latex, which rubber to tap, how do you cut it, the expertise, the skill, which slope you go into, which slope you don't go into, what's the weight of the... There's so much of thinking and engineering going on. And I was astounded because I was a graduate. Mm-hmm. I followed this particular comrade who was a rubber tapper for many, many years. And I was amazed at how she was able to look at all these things and do all the calculations. Similarly, also when I followed another comrade who went for harvesting palm oil fruit with a huge knife, that is not an easy job. I could not harvest one fruit because I did not have the physical ability, nor did I have the technical know-how. He was able to harvest a lot of bunches, the same day. So this is another false narrative that we all are made to believe in, that manual work, you have to pay them less, it's a 3D job, they don't think, they are robots. It's nonsense. Everyone has got different expertise. And those CEOs who are sitting in boardrooms and sitting in meeting rooms, yes, they're doing a lot of thinking, the strategy, but I think the amount of work, the amount of energy, the amount of expertise they're putting in, it's the same thing which any other human being is doing. So I think that we should go away with this and we should pay according to the value they're creating. We should do away with this traditional thinking of having this class and that class, because it only justifies for them to earn more.
On the show with me today is Sivarajan Arumugam, Secretary General at Parti Socialist Malaysia. After the break, I ask him what socialism means in the 21st century. Keep it here on Think Left on Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Beyond the Ballot Box. I'm Darshan Johan, and on the first episode of our Think Left series, I'm joined by Sivarajan Arumugam, Secretary General at Parti Socialist Malaysia, and we're discussing socialism. What exactly is it, and how would it work in the 21st century? So, Siva, let's talk about this solution to capitalism or a different way of thinking. You've alluded to this a little bit in the past couple of questions, but in a nutshell, what exactly is socialism?
When you talk about socialism, I think what it basically means is that we are looking at a system whereby the resources of this world and the work and the wealth that we're creating, it must be fair and it must be shared among everyone who is participating in this whole economic system that we are in. We are moving towards a society whereby as human beings, we are an economic being, okay? And thus, everyone will contribute to produce certain things. But the problem is that when we have a certain group of people, either through their inheritance or through the whole colonial history, that some people have this immense wealth and they have created this whole disparity, they have always been the people who have owned the means of production here, either be it resources, be it the factories, or just capital itself, okay? So what has happened is that they have always kept this, and we have no other choice. The rest of the people in this world have no other choice but to only offer our labor. Now, why is this so? This is the question that we ask today. In a world which has, we have so much abundance of everything, the world has given us everything in terms of land, water, and everything. But why we find that only a certain people are holding on to it. So we want to have a system whereby how do we collectively own these resources? And if we do that, then we take away the profit motive because we look at it in a collective perspective for everyone to benefit. The core problem of capitalism is that where everyone has got this profit motive and is always expanding. So as long as the profit motive is there, there's always a tendency whereby you go all out to expand and to exploit and to extract more than you need. And that's the problem that we have today. So in socialism, what we think is that especially in current technologies that we have today, we have enough technologies to provide for everyone. We have enough to produce for everyone. But yet, once you put the whole thing under the market perspective, that means even though the society is able, has the expertise, has the tools to provide for everyone, but everyone, for them to access these necessities, you have to go into the market.
Right.
And once you go into the market system, what it means, do you have money to buy or you don't have money to buy? That is what the market tells you. So here's where the whole disparity becomes. So those who don't have money to buy, too bad. Those who have money to buy, you'll get it. So why do we live in a society where the market rules us, where we as a conscious being living in this world were able to produce? And all of these products are just before, we can see it with our own eyes. But we cannot use it because we are convinced that it has to go through this market system, and this the market system, it divides us. I mean, how would you feel when every day you go to a factory, you're producing, just say, 10 cookies every day.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, at 5 p.m., the manager from his office, he steps down and he grabs 8 cookies and goes back home and you end up with 2 cookies. Are you motivated to come back the next day to work? Obviously not.
Yeah.
This is exactly what we're saying. You know, how can you be motivated when very clearly you're being extracted, you're being exploited of your wage? But people are continue to do this because they have no other choice. You sell your labor to this factory or you sell your labor to another factory who might take away 9 cookies
right.
and pay you less. This is not freedom.
Yeah.
So what we are talking about is that for you to realize your full potential, for you to give your full freedom, is that we need to have a system whereby I can produce, I can own what I produce, and I can manage that. So let's collectively own a production mode. Let's collectively decide how do we sell this thing. Let's collectively share our profits. There are examples even in Spain. There's one place known as Mondragon in Spain, mm-hmm. where people are involved in businesses, or people are involved in production factories, and they collectively own it. So there's always a motivation for them to say that, oh yes, I might not be someone who's doing the accounts. I might not be someone who's planning the advertising for their particular firm, but I'm on the production floor. But I am an equal owner of that particular business with the same executive or whoever it is who's doing the accounting sitting up in the office. We are both equals because we both own. But I do my work in the production floor. The accountant does his work in the office. That's right. Only different. So when we do that, there is a motivation. I have collective ownership and thus I will produce more. I will give you ideas to do more. Now, isn't that a better system where people collectively think about things, you know? This is what socialism we're aspiring for.
Siva, talk to me about some of the socialist policies we have adopted, and see, we as in Malaysia, has adopted since independence in this country, and how people take that for granted or may not even realise that these are socialist policies to begin with.
Post-independence, in terms of land reform, the systems of things we look at today, like FELDA, whereby the person who was working on the land, they were given the rights of the land to work in. They were given a certain plot. So in terms of land reform, those we can say were socialist policies. So in terms of land reform and how we executed, Tun Abdul Razak executed the FELDA scheme, we can look at it as some which has been inspired by socialist policies. Malaysia, we had a very good healthcare system. That means the public healthcare was the core, was the main priority of healthcare for all of the population. And that's why I think during the 80s and 70s, among the region in ASEAN and even in Asia, we were among the top in terms of providing healthcare. No one else really had, for a country who just had independence, you know, a couple of decades, we had really very good healthcare in terms of the cost-wise, in terms of the experience and so on. So these kind of policies we can look at, those are inspired by socialist policies. They're inspired by things that putting people first. If you look at what the socialism would inspire for, is that to be a government of the people, and thus the basic necessities must be provided for. and it cannot be privatized. But now, under neoliberalism after the 1990s, even in Malaysia, we saw it during the Mahathir era, we saw this thing slowly being eroded. And that is why the problems that we're having today, whereby this whole landscape has changed now. The public sector has been compromised. Even the government healthcare sector has been compromised. Not too much, not too bad compared to the other countries, whereby like in America, it's completely like an insurance system. You know, you have insurance, you live, you don't have, you die.
You talk about capitalism and how capitalism, it basically, you know, reduces human being to their abilities to generate wealth for other people. And that's essentially what you are. If you cannot generate wealth for someone else, you're a useless person, and that's it. What would labor or work look like in a socialist environment?
I think, like I said, where labor is given dignity, I think that's the core things that even Marx talks about, giving dignity to labor. Because what capitalism has done is alienated people from every aspect. It has separated people from their labor, separated people from their product of labor, alienated people from all aspects of mode of production. So it's basically is that you have no dignity at all. If you look at the capitalist production model that we have today, if you walk into any of these factories, any multinational factories, I mean, people really do not know what actually they're producing, because basically time in and time out for years, they could be just soldering a chip into a circuit board, right? He could be working there for 20 years.
Right.
He have no idea how to put together a telephone, but he would be a contributory factor. His labor would be contributory to producing an iPhone, but he has no idea to put it together. So this is what we say is alienation of labor, whereby you are contributing, you're working, you're slogging every day, but you don't see your labor manifest. And that is why I think this is human nature. Capitalism is something which goes against human nature. What is human nature? Do you see why people, after slogging long hours in work, they seek hobbies? What is hobby actually? And hobby is something that you like to do, and you like to see the fruits of your labor in front of you. You want to paint something. You want to do gardening. You want to do carpentry. Why do humans want to do this after their office hours? Why can't they find the same satisfaction at their workplace? Because as humans, we need to see the fruits of our labor. And what capitalism has done is alienated us from all of this. We don't see the products. We cannot see the iPhone that we produce. We cannot afford the iPhone that we produce.
Right.
Okay. No way. So it has basically just converted us into machines. We just go in 8 hours. We don't talk to the worker beside us. It has made us something which is lower than human.
Right.
So what under socialism, what we are saying is that we give you back that dignity whereby your labor is valued for, firstly. The second thing is that you understand what is happening in this production. That's why we talk about ownership. You own the means of production. So if it's a factory, let's have a system where we can collectively own. I mean, these kind of things, there are experiments happening throughout all over the world. But these remain as experiments because they are always attacked by the capitalist countries, the transnational companies, which don't allow these companies to expand and so on. So we have to think about this thing. We have to expand these models and make it feasible. The other thing is that also deciding for the new needs of humankind. So the problem with capitalism is that once there's only a small group of elite business people decide on what should be produced, when should be produced, and how much should be produced, it is only for their own benefits. It is not for human needs.
Right.
That is why today we see that we have all the technology that we want, but all is being diverted to produce items which are really not necessary for luxury, even something which is detrimental to our health. But with the same technology cannot be diverted to increase medicine production, to increase production of educational facilities maybe, because they see this as not something which is not profitable. The motive for profit is always there, overwhelming the actual need of humankind. So that is why in a socialist country, we would say that the masses, the working people, will have to decide who themselves are workers. They decide what is actually needed for humankind. So if a worker owns a factory, he will decide, now why should I produce weapons of mass destruction. I don't want to do that. I'm just going to kill my another brother in another country. Let us use this technology. Let us use this capital to produce vaccines, like what Cuba is doing.
Right.
So this kind of thinking will only come if there's not a small group of elite deciding on what to produce, but the masses of people decide what to produce. I mean, you can go anywhere. Maybe you ask Malaysians, you do a referendum, you ask Malaysians, what do we want to produce? They will give you brilliant ideas. You know, they'll say, yes, I think we need a better infrastructure. Let's do a reforestation. You know, we are fed up with all these floods happening everywhere. So this is what common people think about. And can we produce this? Of course we can. But if you ask a capitalist what they want to produce, I want to produce a skyscraper, 118 floors, because I can sell the property, I can make money, I can make rental.
I want to pick up on a point you brought up earlier, very interesting, about this alienation of labor and how, you know, there are people who are just slogging for 20 years and they're just sitting there behind a conveyor belt and they're just, you know, doing benign tasks which they also cannot reap the rewards to it and all of that. A lot of people will say that, oh, that's because they didn't study hard enough. That's because they didn't, have the expertise through whether it's their own hard work, their own smart work, their own dedication. And hence, that's the job that they should, you know, that they are doing for 20 years. Whereas if you study hard enough, if you do well in schools, so on and so forth, then you will be the person who can then afford that iPhone or doing work, more interesting work, so to speak. You know, people tend to talk about these workers in factories as they are there because it's their own fault. That this is the consequences of their actions, not going to school or so on and so forth. How would you respond to that?
I think it is also something which is quite amazing how we have some thinking like this. Let's look at it this way. You know, okay, you said you have studied hard, you're in a good job, you're affording certain luxuries in life, you have a condominium, you have a car, but someone has to build all of these things, right? You are, even though whatever studies you have, you are not going to be the one who's going to pick up those bricks, put together those concretes, put together all those iron bars and build a condominium for yourself. Someone is going to build it for you. So here's again, that what I'm coming back to is that as a society, humans, we will need to produce things that we need. So it could be houses, it could be basic stuff, it could be foodstuffs. We still need the farmer who goes into the mud, puts his foot into the mud every day so that you can have rice on the table every day. So everyone needs to do their own part. So it's unthinkable to think about. Some people think that, okay, yes, so that everyone is a graduate now and so on, no one needs to go to the farm. I mean, what do you want to do for your daily food? No? So I think the problem here is that we need to sort of move away from this way of thinking and to say that everyone has a role. But unfortunately, what has happened today is that we, under this capitalist system, in this class society, we are starting off from different starting lines. That's the problem. A family which has been in poverty due to their fathers who have lived in maybe in estates or whatever it is. So they start from a different line. You know, they might go to the same school as probably a person who's in town, probably a son of a government servant, but they start from a different starting line. So when you start from a different starting line in the race, you will end up in a different place. Okay?
Absolutely.
So let's recognize that, you know, and this is the problems of society we have today. But on top of that, again, we should also have the simple, rational understanding that a society is built on people with different capabilities and people who do different jobs, from 3D jobs up to jobs which are able to provide for thinking, for technology, for engineering and so on, you know. And everyone has to be respected because without one, the other cannot survive. I mean, this is nature. We have seen it in nature, how nature itself works, how the bees work, the pollination. So everyone has got a job. I mean, this is common sense, isn't it? It's only in mankind whereby we think along class lines. You know, say, yeah, you are lower, you're a Bangladeshi, you're a migrant, blah, blah, blah. I mean, how? So every time I'm very amazed also, every time during Raya comes, you know, there'll be all our foreign comrades, foreign workers coming to town, having their day in Raya. And suddenly you get the news coming up, you know, so many migrants have taken over Kuala Lumpur. So you did not know they were migrants when they were working in the factories? You did not know migrants when they were building your highways. You did not see them when they were building your condominiums. But you very happily drove on the highways. You stayed in their condominiums, which they built. And when they took the time off to come to the cities, you found them to be an eyesore.
We now have fully sort of integrated into a global capitalist system. And admittedly, when you talk to a lot of people, people say that it has brought about some things that people enjoy. Certain luxuries. You talk about things that people don't need. People enjoy a lot of things that they don't need. And people have gotten used to the current system. With that in mind, what exactly does socialism mean in the 21st century? Not just 21st century, what does socialism mean today?
What the world is seeing today is basically the problems that socialists have talked about, I mean, decades ago. We pointed out the problems of this extractive economy, which is basically based on greed and not based on need. How we're exploiting the environment, how we have gone beyond on what we need and just producing. So today, all of this is coming back to us in a way, what we call today climate change.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to say that, oh, okay, this is something, not something socialists are propagating about. No, the whole world scientists are talking about it, climate change, and we are facing it in Malaysia. Everyone is accepting it. So why we are in this state today? So this actually proves that at the core of it, we have a problem with this economic system. And what this economic system is doing to us is that it's basically pushing us towards into this whole lifestyle of consumption, creating this false scarcity, you know, and these things that becomes obsolete when they can be used for a very long time. I mean, all of us, we know that some of the stuff that we would have bought maybe 30, 40 years ago would have lasted for a lifetime.
Right.
But today, with all the current technology, with all the nanotechnology we're talking about today, things are made to get spoiled, you know. I inherited, until today, my bookshelf is a bookshelf that I inherited from my father, and he got it as a wedding present in 1957. I have it today.
Right.
And it has all my books there. Okay, so you just imagine that. You see, because that's the thing is that this whole thing that humans were able to build and able to produce stuff which could last for a lifetime, it shows that humans had that technology. We had the ability. We had the know-how. But why suddenly in this technological age that we're talking about today, we're unable to sustain it? Because what has overwhelmed, what has taken over is that the whole thinking of profits. For you to reap profits, you must continue to produce and you must continue to create that illusion and that atmosphere and the lifestyle that you continuously need to have new things upgraded. So it is a whole marketing thing which goes into telling you that, no, this is not good enough and you have to go for something better. It's all those things which have been created in this generation under this production model, and it is made to break, right? So we have this all comes into a planned economic model that they wanted it to be this way, basically because they wanted to have people to consume. This is something which is orchestrated very cleverly by this whole capitalist system.
You know, we talk about socialism, we talk about a class society, we talk about the business class versus the proletariats, the working class. These two classes have opposing interests with one another. But in 2022, what does that mean, actually? Because the idea of business as well has evolved, right? You may have a small digital business on Instagram. You may be selling nasi lemak at the roadside. That's your business. So there's loads of different types of business, especially in the digital age. So how do you look at this class-based society in 2022?
Yes, as you correctly pointed out, it is not a very distinctive line which separates this is a business class, this is a working class. No, it does not. What we see in society today is very, very complex, unlike what was there during Marx's time. So today, I think we have like the top, really top transnational companies, multinational companies. Then we have even like the government-owned companies. Then we have the big national businesses, and then we have the small industry, then we have the micro businesses, and then we have the one-man shows. And today we have what we know as the what we call the precariats, which are not workers, at the main time they're not entrepreneurs, right? Also, right? So we have the precariats running around everywhere, delivering food and all that. So we have a wide variety. But I think what we can base it on is that as a guideline for us is that whether a person is only owning the means of production or whether he's only selling his labor for it. That is one part of it. But again, I think does not mean that, okay, it's not a black and white kind of situation. For socialists today, what is more important is that we are here to mobilize the masses against an opponent which is exploiting, all right? So if there is a huge transnational company which is sort of really pressing on the micro business, the small petty bourgeois, we will be on the side of the petty bourgeois, you know, against this big multinational company, because probably the petty bourgeois has earned a hard-earned living, honest business. Why should he be oppressed? Why should he be evicted? Right. Why should he be bought over by a big Walmart or something like that? So we, as socialists, we will be on the side of the petty bourgeois to defend his business. So I think things are not as those days, whereby we have to look at certain things, whether they are exploiting us, they're oppressing us, they're extracting our labor, and we should be always on the part of defending this group of people. The other thing also is that I think when you talk about class society, we are mobilizing them in different perspectives. It's not only on what is based on the working floor, not only based on the economic working floor, but on a whole lot of other issues. So you could be a SME person, you could be a business owner, but you could be in a situation whereby you are fighting from your house being demolished, all right, from a highway being built, or you are fighting against climate change, or you're fighting against another issue of healthcare issue. You're being denied getting healthcare. So in that way, we are also able to bring all these people again together from different backgrounds. And especially as PSM, we have realized this when we were mobilizing against forced evictions, when we were doing cases with urban pioneers, from people from the kampung. And people in the kampung who have lived in near the cities, they come from various backgrounds. We have the makcik selling the nasi lemak, up to maybe a business guy, probably is having a small cloth shop, or maybe it's having some kind of internet business. So we bring all of these people together, but not on the perspective of whether you are a businessman, you are a worker, not, but on the perspective that you are fighting for your rights to defend your land, to defend your house. So I think in that way, the oppressor and the being oppressed, it manifests in many different ways. And we will be always on the side of the oppressed, fighting against these manifestations of oppressions of capitalism itself. Our struggle is much, much wider. It's starting from climate change up to worker struggle, from daily workers, from migrants, you know, it has really moved all the way. So now it's basically the 99% against the 1%.
Right. People for the past 20 years, 30 years, especially the markets, like you said, like the markets rule the world, essentially, you know. Is socialism in today, is it anti-markets? Do socialists want to come in and just abolish markets altogether?
We do need markets, okay? In a place where we can trade, we can exchange goods, everything is available. Markets are important. Socialists are not saying that we have to do away with markets. The problem is that how markets have sort of like are ruling us. That is a problem that we have today. So that's why until today, what we would argue is that markets are important for the distribution of goods which are necessary, and the distribution, and to make sure that everyone will be able to get this time, the items that they need according to the time and so on. But the problem is what even Adam Smith would not have really thought about, because he would have thought about an ideal system whereby there's a demand and supply and price will be controlled. You know, there's an invisible hand which will actually manage everything. But what it has developed today is something which is very different. We have a monopoly system. We have speculation. We have a manipulative system today. So in today's sense, we have to safeguard certain needs from being manipulated by this market, which has been, we can say, it's been adulterated, right? Not as the market system which Adam Smith would have perceived in those days. So that is why that we always find is that those basic necessities, we cannot let it be part of the market in terms of housing for the people, If you put it into the market, this is the problem that we're going to have today. There's no way that you can buy a house today, especially young people. And if Adam Smith actually lived today, he would be actually, he'll be really puzzled, Because on one hand, we have the masses of people, working people, who are asking for houses at 100,000, 200,000, because this is what they can afford.
Right.
According to their pay, according to the finance they can get from their banks. But we find that the market, or the supply part of the market, it is so adamant and it does not want to meet this particular demand. It is just keeping building houses which are 400,000, 500,000, 600,000, even though there's an oversupply. There's an oversupply in Johor, in Selangor. And up to today, they are so adamant because they still want to maximize their profits. So Adam Smith has failed. Correct?
Right.
So here's what we say is that once we are living in this kind of situation, when the whole thing has been manipulated, there's a lot of speculation. So that's why socialists, what we want to make sure is that those which are your basic needs, your housing, your education, your healthcare, cannot be privatized, cannot be put into the market. These things must be safeguarded against this mechanism so that people will continue to have these benefits. There's a lot of manipulation, also the financial market part, which has also, I think, gone haywire. And even if you look in Malaysian scenario itself, basically institutions are being created as shell companies so that money can flow through. So it basically dismisses the whole concept of building an organization, building a business, having expertise and providing for the needs of the economy, providing jobs. So people have just moved away from all of these things. They're not bothered about providing for the country. It's just basically finance, manipulation. I can build a company here. The company has got no expertise. Probably just have a front desk and two secretaries sitting in front. I think that was basically what is 1MDB all about. So they could have money flowing from Saudis, from Saudi, from here and everything, and goes into the political funding. So this is the capitalism that we have today. So here is where we say the markets have failed. So once the markets have failed so bad, why are we still defending it? The other part is that why do we find that there's so much of surplus value? Like earlier we talked about under feudalism, where there's no place they could invest all the surplus value, and they were building castles and temples and so on. So here again, this greed plays again, where they are not investing on productive economy, but they're putting their money into these financial markets for quick gains.
Right.
It is not helping anyone, It's just basically buying the stock and selling the stock. It is not a value which is actually created from any kind of labor. It's just gambling.
Right.
And there's a lot of money there. So all of these things could be used into the economy, but it's not being done.
Right.
So how do we regulate all this? So here is where what we socialists are saying, that this world cannot go on like this anymore. We have seen this crisis happening too many times. Everyone knows about it. But everyone is so skeptical and so afraid to say that, yes, capitalism is not working. Let's move to another economy. Everyone was always like, I think the car is fine. Let's try to repair it a bit. But no, we are already moving into an era whereby, as Rosa would say, it's either socialism or barbarism. We are already there.
On that note, thank you so much for joining me today, Siva. That was Sivarajan Arumugam, Secretary General at Parti Socialist Malaysia. If you missed any part of our conversation, you can check us out on podcasts. We are available on the BFM app, bfm.my, or pretty much wherever you get your podcasts from. I'm Darshan Johan, and this has been Think Left on Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.